joining us from Dogs by Nature, covering the Cleveland Browns right there for Sports Nation, and having a chance to work and really get into not only the Cleveland Browns, but also the history of the NFL and more. Barry Shuck joining us here. Barry, appreciate your time, and really looking forward to, you know, another fun week in the NFL.
A really nice day on the Gulf Coast again, isn't it?
It's a beautiful day, and you know, I'm not going to bring up too much or harp on that score. This isn't, you know, I don't put salt and wounds on people I like. That's not, you saw how I worded that, but when it comes down to looking right now at last week's game with Cleveland, you know, the whole Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, you can say that easy. It's almost a cliche for a lot of teams, but it really, Baker Mayfield to me is the epitome of that guy. When things are going well, he's loving life. When things are bad, he's the guy sleeping in mom's basement and doesn't want to get up for work.
Yeah, New England absolutely destroyed Cleveland. And what was weird is Cleveland's forte is stopping the run, and the Patriots just ran right up the gut, right around the corners. The jet sweeps, the screens out in the flats, all of that just killed them.
You know, and Barry, one thing, though, if you look at Kevin Stefanski, it's sort of been an up and down. Last year, he, you know, the coach of the year was right there, and he, you know, it was a great season for what he accomplished. Then inside the numbers, though, you look, and you cover Cleveland, so you know this, but it was a little misleading being 11-5 because their point differential, points scored against points against was not that good. It was around where a lot of the 8-8, 7-9 teams were, but they did find a way to win a lot of close games, and they did go to the playoffs and were a few plays away against Kansas City for moving on to the AFC title game, and they destroyed a team that their fans love destroying in Pittsburgh and put them out immediately in that first game. But I want to ask you the question, where would you rank Kevin Stefanski's overall grade over his first 2 years?
Well, the NFL Coach of the Year is not always the best coach. It's not the coach that takes the team to the Super Bowl. You would think that's what it is, but the NFL Coach of the Year traditionally has been voted on as the guy that takes the biggest leap with a team and makes them from a poor to weak team to a good team. And that's how that goes. Stefanski last year took them to 11-5. It'd been 17 years since they've been to the playoffs. But if you look at that, 17 wins last year, they played out of those games last year, they played the NFC East. So there was four wins right there. Sorry, Drew, but they beat the Cleveland, the Cincinnati Bengals twice. Uh-huh. So there was two W's. And then we were gifted with games against Jacksonville, Houston, the New York Jets. So you take a team that won 11 games, in reality, they beat all the bad teams and couldn't beat the good teams.
Yeah, I think that, you know, some teams are like that, though. I think that some teams have a little bit of a history of being able to beat the teams who they're supposed to, but then they struggle to beat the teams that are elite, and that's what puts them, you know, as middle of the road as possible. At this point, you know, the AFC seems to be relatively wide open. The NFC has still got some of the powerhouse teams that I think people expected. The Rams are up there, even though after they, you know, just had a tough loss recently. The Cardinals are up there, the Buccaneers, the Packers. In the AFC, I mean, the Bills are leading the division, but the Patriots are right behind them. The AFC North is arguably the best division in football. And the Chargers haven't looked particularly great over the last couple of weeks. It seems like the AFC has got a lot of questions to still, you know, figure out over the next, you know, 4 or 5 weeks.
Absolutely. The Tennessee Titans just look like man beaters to me.
Yeah.
And the Kansas City Chiefs have kind of righted themselves at 6-4. They were 3-4 for a while, but they've won three in a row. But they're leading that division because the Chargers were taking it for so long. But I still think it's the Ravens, the Bills, and the Titans, if you ask me.
Well, it's going to be exciting this year. I think at this point, it's just a matter of time in the NFC between Green Bay and Tampa Bay. That's my opinion. And I'm not saying that I'm ruling out Arizona or some of these, but when it gets to the put on your big boy pants in the playoff time, I do believe that even with Matthew Stafford, they've looked bad the last couple weeks. But I think it's going to come down to Green Bay or Tampa Bay. One of those teams is winning it, and frankly, I think one of those teams is winning it all. But if you look at the AFC, it is really wide open. You could say that Tennessee was playing the best football, but they don't have Derrick Henry. You can say that New England right now is playing the best football, but we'll see. Even tonight, it's Thursday Night Football, and they play Atlanta, and who knows if they win that. It's so cyclical right now, which makes the NFL better, but what are you expecting this week with Cleveland against Detroit? One thing is, I mean, you write for a living, so you know, have a number of different paragraphs and go through and get quotes, but really, as Charlie Sheen said, winning should be the only thing when you play Detroit, but they do have that one tie, so there we go.
Yeah, and there's two ways to think of this. If the Browns are a Jekyll and Hyde team, which they are, and so are the Bengals, and so are the Chiefs, and so are the Chargers. They're Jekyll and Hyde team. They're not up and coming. You look at New England. They've won four in a row. You know New England's on the uptick, and they're only a half game out from Buffalo. But you take a team like Detroit that is 0-8-1. But if you look at their record, they've gotten blown out three times by the Packers and by the Bengals, but they stayed close, and by the Eagles, they stayed close to the Rams. They stayed close. They've only lost by 2 points to the Vikings, 2 points to the Ravens, who I would predict to go to the Super Bowl. So, and they weren't far behind from the 49ers, who have been a roller coaster as well. So if you look at their team, they kind of remind me of the Bengals of last year. The Bengals last year lost five games by 5 points or less. If you add those five games to their win total, what kind of record do they have? They could have been fighting for that seventh seed. That's the way I look at the 0-8-1 Lions this year. Is there's just been a couple of games, three or four, that they easily could have won, and they would just be a middle-of-the-road NFL team at this point.
Speaking with Barry Shuck of Dogs by Nature, check out his work, talking Cleveland Browns and NFL football. Barry, if you look right now at what we've seen so far in the NFL this year, and really you look at the schedules down the – and if the Browns do make the postseason, they earned it, because down the stretch, big games, I mean, you're talking about in the final couple weeks of the year, you've got games against the Packers, at the Steelers, at the Packers, versus the Bengals. But right now, after they play Detroit, and I know they do have the bye in between it, but for a multi-billion-dollar league, how does the NFL survive by doing? To me, this is, I don't want to use the word stupid, but what do you make of having the Ravens back to back? That just doesn't make much sense, where you could scatter all these teams and 32 teams, and you put back to back games against Baltimore. Is there a reason for that on the schedule?
Well, of course, there's a bye week in between. I saw an NFL special on NFL Network about how the schedule was made. And I know back in the day when there was only 12 teams, back when Joe Carr was the commissioner, back in the 40s and the 50s, he did the schedule on dominoes. And what he did for the schedule is that he took all the dates from all the teams that they couldn't play a home game, and then there were games like the Giants always wanted to play the Bears at home. The Bears always wanted to play the Giants at home because those two were good draws. And he took all that into account, and that's how the schedule was done. Well, now they had seven different ways to do the schedule. They did seven different schedules, and they presented it to the commissioner, and the commissioner is who whittled it down to four, and then they presented the four to him, and he picked one, and that's how the schedule's done. It's all done with a crew of people. There's five people that input all this information, and a lot of that information is, you take like the Buffalo Bills. The Bills, every preseason, they must play in Toronto. The Giants and the Jets in preseason have to play. The Browns and the Bengals in preseason have to play. And it's a lot of home and away. It's within the division. And, of course, every year you play a totally different division that is out of your conference or out of your division. Last year the Browns and the AFC North played the NFC South. This year they're playing the AFC West and every team in that division. So it just rotates around. I watched the show and I was just flabbergasted at all the information that they had to put in.
Yeah, it sounds like a really complicated process, you know, that it used to be.
It is. It is. Absolutely it is. They have a full-time five-member team, and, of course, three of them are data entry people that put all this information in, because you take like the Dallas Cowboys, their home field is used for a lot of things other than Cowboy games. So it might be a Fleetwood Mac concert, and so they'll say, well, hey, on these days we can't use the stadium. Or it might be Alabama and Arkansas at that stadium on a Saturday, and they don't want to get it ready for the game the next day. So they have all these conflicts that they have to input all that, and that goes way beyond where, like, a hurricane comes and the Saints have to relocate for three or four or five games. Because back in the day, I remember they played preseason games in a lot of different cities, like Austin, Texas, Jacksonville, Florida, Birmingham, San Antonio, Sacramento. They played a lot of preseason games. In fact, the American Football League from 1960 to 1969 played 8 preseason games in Mobile at Ladd Stadium.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding, you know, how all that works. Well, there's one question I got for you. So sticking in the AFC North, the
sure.
Ravens. So they've been back and forth the last few weeks. They lose to the Bengals. They get killed by the Bengals. They come back and they barely beat Minnesota. Then they lose on the road at Miami, a pretty bad loss that it looked for Baltimore. How pivotal are these next 4 or 5 weeks of the season? Because if you look at the schedule, they have the Bears this week. So, okay, say they win that one. But Lamar has been sidelined with a non-COVID illness, so who knows if he'll be ready. Then they got Browns at the Steelers, at the Browns again, home against the Packers, the Bengals on the road, and then the Rams again. I mean, how pivotal are these next 4 or 5 games for the Ravens to finish out the regular season?
And then they finish the season with a second game against the Steelers. It's
right.
That's a brutal schedule. Brutal schedule. I think they'll take the Browns, both of them. I think they'll split with the Steelers. The Rams, I don't know. I think they could probably defeat the Bengals. Or then again, who knows if the Bengals are going to show up. I think they're a strong team. I think they could win every one of those games. The Rams and the Packers games would be the only two that I think would be a flip of a coin. But the rest, I think they can take it.
Barry, one more question here. When it comes to fascinating stats, we were talking off the air and about the situation with the NFL and the history of the NFL. There's some fascinating stats like that probably people aren't going to lose sleep learning, like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia during the World Wars came together to make the Pittsburgh Steagles. They took they had both teams together and they played. But when it came down to a lot of the NFL crazy facts, what are some of the ones that you find the most fascinating?
Well, originally it was 5 yards and 3 downs. The origins of the game was 5 yards, and they gave 3 downs. Another odd rule was a punt was an offensive play. So when you punted the ball, whoever jumped on the ball, it was their possession. That got changed in the late 40s. Another fascinating stat is the origins of the snap came from, well, of course, American football came from rugby, and rugby came from soccer. So there's a lot of things in American football that are because of rugby and because of soccer. That's why they play 11-a-side, because soccer plays 11-a-side. They have red flags and yellow flags. They have punts and kickoffs and goals and goal lines. All this came from soccer. But how rugby starts with a ball is you have a scrum, and you have members from both teams. You throw the ball in, and one guy takes his foot from each team, and they try to grab it with their foot, and they hit it with their heel, and it's called heeling. And originally, American football, that's how the ball was put into play. The center stood over the ball, he took his heel, and he kicked it back to the quarterback, and then play went on. Well, what would happen is, as soon as he would heel the ball, the player in front of him would push him, and then it was a fumble. Well, the second thing that happened was that the center can snap it sideways to the quarterback, and he would stand over the ball, he would crouch over the ball, but he would lift it sideways. The same thing would happen. The defensive tackle across from it would take his hand and swat the ball out. Well, the originator of American football is Walter Camp. He was in Toronto to see a game between Saskatchewan and Toronto, and they snapped it between their legs, which protected the ball. And he came back to the States and implemented that. So that is how we snap the ball today, through the legs, because Walter Camp came by back to the United States and then saw that. Now, here's a little footnote. It's still perfectly legal to snap the ball sideways, although nobody does it.
That's crazy. Yeah, and those are stats. Did you know, Barry, and I'm learning more and more about, you know, being an NFL encyclopedia, it's so much fun. Jeff Davis, who works with us, is an encyclopedia on Florida Gator knowledge. But when it comes down to, did you know what happened in that Miami and Florida State game? Because I was a play-by-play broadcaster in college football, and even the people on the field didn't know. Miami obviously did not know. But did you know that if you spike a football with less than 3 seconds, that the game's over if you don't have timeouts?
Was it do a 10-second runoff?
No, it's a rule in college football. What happened at the end of the Miami and Florida State game, and good thing it was, they would have had to throw about a 65-yard Hail Mary to win anyway, but they were down by 3 points, and they got the ball, and there was, at this
there
point,
there
was three
left.
Seconds left, and the guy spikes it after the first down.
And the official came on the loudspeaker and said, "You're given the rule that you're not able to spike a ball in 3 seconds. The game's over," and they ended it right then and there. But I thought it was 2 seconds because I thought most
I
definitely
never have
you
heard
took
of that.
Three seconds. Yeah. It doesn't take 3 seconds to spike a ball. You get it, and you throw it straight down.
Clearly, the coach, nobody knew. Like the coach and the player didn't know the rule, and they're on the field.
It shouldn't be a rule anyway.
It should not be a rule. I don't understand the rule.
Yeah, I have seen rules come across that I'd never seen before. I remember watching a Arizona Cardinals game, and it was right before the half, and the team did a pooch kickoff. No, it was right after a safety, and he did a pooch punt up in the air, and the Cardinals called for a fair catch. And then they had what was called a fair catch kick, a field goal attempt. I had never heard of this. The field goal kicker lines it up where they had the fair catch, which happened to be on the 45 of the Cardinals. So it was, you know, 45, 55, 55 yards. It ended up being, I think, 65 yards all in all, but unimpeded. It's like a kickoff, but he can use a tee, but he can only use a one-inch tee. And before that even happened, I had never heard of such a rule before. It's like the Broncos-Cowboys game. The Cowboys blocked the punt. It went forward across the line of scrimmage. A Cowboy player touched it. Then he fumbled it. Then the Broncos picked it up and gained 10 yards. And in the end, they ended up with the ball with about a 20-yard gain. I had never seen that before.
I have never – there are things that that are crazy to talk about, but yeah, and that's one of them. But you know, I always said too in college, and I've never really got a right answer. It's more just like, well, don't worry about it, kind of thing. I'm like, well, that you're not answered. But in college, imagine. So we all know in college, if your knee's down, then officially the ball's dead. Correct.
Correct.
Okay, so why can a placeholder catch the ball with his knee down? And what if it was a high snap where he has to get it and then put his knee down, and then you can kick an extra point?
In college.
Yeah, yeah. Why? But, I mean, like, why is that? I mean, but what I mean is, like, so if he – what if he caught that ball and he just, like, looks to the right like he was maybe going to juke on a fake? Does that mean he can't put his knee down? Like, that's what I'm trying
to – Yeah, well, the holder, once he catches it, his knee's already down.
Well, yeah, but what if it's a high snap and he has to stand up and then put his knee down? Is it now dead, or can he kick the extra point?
I don't know.
I don't either. That's a
good point.
There's probably some kind of loophole that's written in that you have to do that. Well, you think about football in general. None of the points scored are in the field of play.
That's true. Heck,
none of them.
Well, Barry, today a lot of the players want to score in the field of play by dropping the ball 2 yards short. But I mean, that's you're correct.
But, the field of play is from goal line to goal line. There's no point scored in American football in the field of play. And you even think about a field goal attempt. The crossbar on an upright lines up with the out-of-bounds stripe at the back of the end zone, correct?
Yes.
So the ball, once it crosses into out-of-bounds territory, that is when it becomes a valid three-point play.
So we should be playing CFL rules then. That's what we should be doing. Because Canadian football, they have the post right at the start of the end zone.
They have 25-yard end zones, and the reason they have that is because rugby has 25-yard end zones. There's a lot that happens after a player crosses the line with the ball for a try. There's a lot that happens in rugby. And originally, American football didn't have any end zones. They had just the goal lines. And you had to cross the line, then come back in the field of play and touch the ball down on the ground. That's where we get the term touchdown from. And so they wanted to, once forward passing started in 1906, by 1910, a lot of teams started throwing the ball. Well, you would have to catch it in the field of play, then cross it, and they came up with the idea that we needed an end zone like rugby has so that they could catch it in the end zone. They first tried 25-yard end zones, but most fields for American football were played in college stadiums or baseball stadiums. In college stadiums, all of them had a track that ran around it. So 25 yards didn't fit with the field itself, plus adding another 50 yards. Then they tried 12-yard end zones, and the two extra yards on each end, 4 yards total, still didn't fit the playing field, and that's when they cut it down to 10. And that fit every college team that was involved, and it fit every baseball stadium that pro football teams had. And that's how they got end zones. That was 1912.
Wow. It's crazy the things. I mean, we watch games, and we're learning. All of us have invested our time in football and love it with a passion. And just reeling off these stats, I love this. But there's so many things people don't know. And I working with Coach K Stevenson, a former NFL coach, I ask him a lot. But you know, I found out a couple of weeks ago, because I joked, I said, if a game was on the line, and let's say it was 20-14, and a guy is returning a kick, yeah. You know, even though you'd be a villain to everybody watching and the most unsportsmanlike act ever, if you ran out in a Super Bowl and tackled the guy from the sidelines, are you a hero? But there's actually a rule called the palpably unfair act, where if you do that, then the refs can get together and call it a touchdown from that spot. So, like, most people don't know that. And you're also probably going to be outcasted from the NFL for your history for doing that, because it's one of the most unfair acts ever. That's crazy to even think about that. And also Joe Gibbs, we know about icing the kickers, but Barry, do you remember when he tried to call consecutive timeouts? And if you call consecutive timeouts in the NFL on the same possession, it's known as an unsportsmanlike conduct in 15 yards. They had a 51-yard kick.
Right.
They had to move it up to 36, and Rian Lindell made the kick, and they lost.
Right, absolutely.
So there's
Go
ahead, Barry.
Before I go, I have a database of I've been researching and cataloging football idioms for about 20 years. I've got 56 idioms already saved. You know what idiom is, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so I want to give you a football idiom before I go. I want to tell you how the huddle started. There's a university in Washington, D.C., called Gallaudet University. It's a well-known and prodigious school for the deaf and hard of hearing. Well, in 1894, on their schedule were two other deaf college teams. Their quarterback was Paul Huber, and what he traditionally did in a game was he would just take his team to the line, and he would sign out the play, and then the play would go on. Well, when they played these two other deaf college teams, he didn't want their teams to steal his plays while signing them out in the open. So he moved his teammates back a few yards and had them form a wall to block the view. Well, after a few downs of doing this, his players would just kind of be loosely in formation, and he kind of gathered them together And he told them to huddle closer together so, without any light between them. And that's how the huddle got started.
Ah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Cooler. The only thing I know about for deaf football is that the school in Arkansas has the coolest nickname. They're the Arkansas School of the Deaf Leopards. That's their that's their actual mascot. So, how about that?
and they spell it D-E-F?
D-E-F, yes.
For the band.
Yeah, Arkansas School of the Deaf Leopards. That's really their real mascot. So, yeah, there you go.
Wow.
Hey, you know what? They have fun with it, but yeah, that's crazy though, and a good stat because obviously the huddle, you know, there's shows inside the huddle. I mean, it means something. Obviously, a huge part of football. But Barry, we could do this all day. I love this kind of stuff. But we'll do it next Thursday. We'll continue to push everything. Thank you for all the knowledge and what you do on Dogs by Nature with the Cleveland Browns. We'll continue to let people know where they can find your articles, and we'll do it again next week, my friend.
Sounds good. Enjoyed my time with you.